The Door in the Wall by Marguerite D'Angeli, Chapter 5. One Friday toward the end of September, the monks of the choir stood practicing in the chantry. Standing by the lectern to turn the pages of the missal was Robin in scarlet cassock and white linen cotta. They were singing the Sanctus and had just come to the Amen when the verger appeared. He held up his hand for their attention. "A messenger has come for young Robin from his father," he said. "Let him come with me." Robin followed the verger down the corridor to the parlor, the thud of his crutches alternating with the sound of his soft shoes on the stone floor. Robin wondered who the messenger could be. Alfred the Dane or Rolf the Boyer? It was neither. It was John Go-in-the-Wind, the minstrel who had carried Robin's letter to his father weeks ago. "Good young master," he said to Robin, "this letter I bring from thy noble father in all haste. For long I could not find him, for that the battle did first to one place, then to another. And the Scots be so fierce in fighting that often the battle went against our side." "And how goes it now?" asked Robin. "Is my father alive? Is he well and safe?" "It goes well now," said John, "and here is thy letter." "My thanks, John Go-in-the-Wind," said Robin. Then he took the letter to the light to read it. His hand shook, for it was the first word he had had from his father since early winter, the first letter he had ever received, indeed. And it was exciting to know that now he could read it for himself. "Robin, son of John de Beaufort, from his father, greeting. It grieves me, my son, more than I can tell you, to know that you are ill. I thank heaven it is not the plague you have had, for that enemy has slain more men than battle, besides the women and children it has taken toll of. It shocked me to learn that you had been left to the care of strangers. Your mother would hardly bear it if I should tell her, but I will not. She is with the queen, who is in delicate health. I dare not say where, lest this letter fall into unfriendly hands. She supposes that you are far away from London in Shropshire. It is well. Let her continue to think so, for in truth you soon will be, God willing and your health permitting, for I have requested the prior to arrange your journey with all speed. You will travel in care of Brother Luke and John Go-in-the-Wind. I had a message from Sir Peter only the day before your letter reached me, asking what had happened to you. For John the Fletcher never returned. Some evil befell him, surely, for he was an honorable servant. Sir Peter was wounded while bringing up forces to my aid, so sorely wounded that he has been taken to a castle nearby, where he will stay until he is able to be taken home. The Scots are being slowly pushed back, and we are gaining ground since receiving the added help from London and the nearby towns. The king hopes for a peace by the sacrament of Christmas, but the Scots are a stubborn race. I trust that you are improving in health, my son, and in God's grace. So farewell, your father, Sir John de Beaufort, Thursday after the feast of John the Baptist. Preparations for Robin's departure began immediately. Brother Luke and Brother Matthew, between them, devised a sort of chair saddle in which Robin could ride. Part of it was to be made of iron, then it was to be finished with padding and leather at the saddler's. They made another journey into town, taking to Dame Agnes such of Robin's clothing as needed repair. The ironmonger promised to send the framework to the saddler by the following Monday, as early as he was able. The saddler agreed to have his part of the work done by evening of the next day. Dame Agnes put aside her embroidery to do what was required of her, and she too promised that the work would be finished early in the week. Meantime, John Go-in-the-Wind helped Brother Luke lay out a plan of travel. Brother Andrew took Brother Luke's place as cook's helper, and the prior gave orders for certain foods to be put aside for the journey. When all was ready, saddlebags were filled with clothing on one side and food on the other. There were loaves fresh from the oven, a great slab of bacon, cheese, some dried herring, fruits from the garden, and last of all, a pastry wasset in the top. In it were larks and a rabbit, seasoned with herbs and colored yellow with saffron. The fruits were apples and early pears and plums, which Brother Michael had picked from the trees and vines, kept trained flat along the garden wall. "'Twill be good for noon quench," he said, "when there is no ale to be had, and will mind thee to be thankful for God's gifts." On the morning they set out, the air was crisp and cool. The sun had not risen above the horizon, but it cast a bright glow into the heavens, promising a fair day. Larks rose from the meadow, straight up as if from pure joy, and they sang, Robin thought, as if it had been the first day of the world. He felt sorry to leave Brother Matthew and all the others who had been so good to him, but it was exciting to start out on the long journey. "There are over 100 English miles to go," said John, "Go in the Wind, and frost is not far off, so we must go steadily." He and Brother Luke shared Bayard, the horse, taking turn about, one riding, the other walking beside Robin. They went toward the Oxford Road, then turned westward through Holborn, stopping a moment to pray at each wayside cross, just as if they had been on a pilgrimage. "It is indeed a sort of pilgrimage," said Brother Luke, "for always we shall set forth for the honor of God, and in the hope that young Robin will be even stronger at the end of our journey than he is now." Because it was a market day, the road was crowded with people and animals going toward London. For long, no one had been allowed to come into the city because of the plague. But now that the danger was over, people came from everywhere to exchange goods. Some rode in carts piled high with produce, cabbages and bags of grain, cheese, butter and bacon, chickens and ducks. Some drove flocks of goats and sheep, or led pigs or carried faggots of firewood. By noon, the promise of sunshine failed and the travelers took refuge from a sudden shower under a spreading beech. They were joined by a minstrel who was glad to share their bread and cheese and pay for his entertainment by singing a lay which John Go in the Wind picked out on the harp. "Brother Michael's pears and grapes are a welcome treat to my thirsty throat," said John. "It seems a week since we broke our fast this morning," said Robin, eating hungrily. "We've come a goodly way since early morning," said John, "but we must not linger or we shall not reach the White Swan by nightfall. I have it from Peter the Hayward that it lies but a good day's journey out of London. It is well to be safe housed after dark, for cut purses and roisterers do roam the country hereabout. If my father were with us, we should have no fear of anyone," said Robin. "We shall have faith in the Father of us all," said the friar. It was Brother Luke's turn to ride, so John Go in the Wind walked beside Robin. As he strode along, he began to sing, playing the tune on his harp. The tune was lively and well-measured. Bayard stepped up his pace. The jennet pranced and arched her neck, and Robin wanted to get down and swing along with the others. "Lend me a hand, John Go in the Wind, and set the crutches so I may walk a while," he directed, interrupting the song. Brother Luke looked back to see what was delaying them, but nodded as he saw Robin afoot, and John again plucking the strings of the little harp. They hummed as if they had been voices, so that Robin's fingers itched to touch them. He watched John's fingers as they searched out the tune, how they danced on the strings to make the differing chords. He noticed the smooth wood of the harp and how the strings were held with wooden pegs. He wished he could play on it and wondered if he could make such an instrument. Now that noon was past, there were few people on the road, but soon they fell in with a peasant with a shepherd's crook over his shoulder. They asked the way to the next village. "The village lies just yonder, about an hour's journey," he said. "The road goes through the wood, over the downs, crosses a bridge, then winds up the hill, where thou'lt find a butter cross, where the market is held. Likely there'll be naught to buy there, as 'tis past noon. Beyond the cross, the road turns more northerly, and there is a fork where it divides. Beyond that, I know not how it goes." "Go you to the village?" asked Robin. No, I go to the forest of my lord's manor, where wood for house fires may be gathered. We country folk may have such branches as can be gathered by hook or by crook from the standing trees of the lord's forest. He left them with a good day and crossed the field. Robin grew tired, for he had walked more than a mile. John Go-in-the-Wind helped him into the saddle again and fastened the crutches on behind. A windmill swung its giant arms in slow obedience to the wind, and a farmer passed them, carrying a sack of grain to be ground. Over the treetops, the spire of the village church could be seen, and thatched cottages began to appear at the road's edge. They entered the village, where the stone bridge crossed a stream. The buttercross in the center square stood open to the four winds. The stone paving was still wet from the washing down after market, and the last of the farmers gathered baskets and gear before going home. Brother Luke was ahead, still riding Bayard the horse, but here he stopped and changed places with John Go-in-the-Wind. The road continued to rise beyond the village, winding between hedgerows of hawthorns now starred with rosy fruit. Robin drew his cloak around him, for the air was damp and chilly. About a mile beyond the village, at the top of the hill, they came to the fork in the road. Another cross to the memory of Queen Eleanor stood at the dividing point, but no signpost. "Now by my faith," declared John Go-in-the-Wind, "I know not which road to take." He drew rein and waited for Brother Luke to come abreast of him. "Nor do I," said the friar, "never having traveled this way." "Did he not say the right fork?" asked Robin. "The fellow said not which road leadeth to Oxford," said John, "but I am for the right fork." "My memory serves me ill," said the friar. "Whether he said one or the other, I know not. Let us say the office here at the cross before we go on. Then we shall go to the right. But it may be that we shall not find the white swan and shall have to sleep in a hedgerow." By the time they started on their way again, the wind blew hard and spits of rain warned them of more to follow. Brother Luke drew his cowl over his head and unfolded a furred robe from the pack to put around Robin. For several miles they plodded on without speaking. The rain held off, but dark clouds scudded low and the wind was searching. A lonely peasant cottage stood back from the road, but as yet there was no sign of the white swan. Robin grew very tired and wished the day's journey had come to an end. "Will it be soon, think you?" he asked, not wishing to say how his back ached. "Whether it be soon or late, I know not, answered the friar, "but these old legs need rest." Then he shouted to John Go-in-the-Wind, who was some distance ahead. "What sayest thou, John? How goeth it? Are we near to the inn?" John shook his head and shouted back, turning Bayard and waiting for the others to come up. "We must have taken the wrong fork," he said. "I see no inn, and night is nigh. Ahead lies a dark forest, and see, 'tis raining now. Shall we seek shelter here by the road?" "It is an ill thing for young Robin to sleep out in the damp. But if such be our fortune, then we must make the best of it." "Shall we sleep on the ground?" asked Robin. "What a lark! I have never yet in my life slept out of doors, though it may as well have been out of doors when the east wind blew through the wind hole." "We might go on to the forest and be more sheltered from wind and rain," offered John Go-in-the-Wind. But that wild beasts do roam about and highwaymen lurk in the edge of it to leap out at passerby. I'm for staying here. I have flint and steel to make a fire." He dismounted and led Bayard to the edge of the road where he could examine the lay of the land. Said Brother Luke, "'Tis not for me to sleep in Mother's Nature's arms. Many a night have I been grateful for the comfort of solid ground, and mayhap we can cover young Robin to keep him dry." He followed John to the field's edge. "Why, here 'tis, the very thing," he cried. "An ancient tree trunk, fallen from age and hollowed, will dry with dry rot. It hath stood enough years to make it both wide and deep. We shall not be ill found after all. Come, young master, let me help thee, For I know thou'rt galled by the saddle, but it be it ever so soft. He helped Robin to get down from Jenny's back and adjusted the crutches under his arms. It is good that the fullers do shrink and pound this cloth, for it is well nigh rainproof. The friar went on as he bustled about getting the saddlebags down, putting the furred rug inside the great log, and leading Jenny to be tethered to the thicket. John Go and the Wind tied Bayard beside her, leaving them both on a loose rein so they might crop the grass. Robin stood with his back to the wind, holding his cloak about him. This was a real adventure. Even though he might never be a knight in armor and go to battle to defend England, he would know what it was like to make his bed on God's earth, feel the prick of rain in his face, and instead of brocaded bed curtains, see dark clouds making a canopy over him. John cleared a space shielded from the rain on the far side of the log, where the ground was still dry, then set it about with stones and searched for dry twigs to make his fire. Farther down the sloping meadow, he found a ruined ox yoke left by a careless peasant, which would burn long and well. A few dry leaves and some of the punky rotted wood served as tinder when steel and flint struck a spark in the shelter of the hollow log, and soon there was a cheerful fire which drove back the night and storm. They roasted apples in the fire, but ate the pasty cold, and hunger sauced it better than the finest cook could have done.